in a way, conducting is easy. It's easier to be a fraud as a conductor than it is for many other. I mean, you can't move your hands like this and not have any idea what the orchestra is actually doing and kind of get away with it.
Welcome to another episode of our podcast. This time we are talking about conductors and how they work.
We are
Alan Gilbert
and Michael Pavlitz, and this is about music
and life.
Some are described as dictators. Others follow more or less democratic rules. But do orchestras need conductors at all? Let's deconstruct the myth of the maestro.
Maestro, the maestro idea.
It's the worst idea ever.
But you are a maestro.
No.
Some people call you that, don't they?
Yeah, you know, it's the word is so loaded that I remember the first time I guest conducted a major orchestra. It was really one of the first things I ever did as a professional conductor. Cincinnati Symphony.
Yeah.
I won a competition in Geneva in 94. And what happened is at the winner's concert, which was right a few days after the final round, there was a winner's concert that was televised on Arte all around Europe. And in a way, it was a wonderful chance because I was suddenly on a Europe-wide televised concert and I was just starting out. But it was also kind of annoying because I worked so hard and there was so much stress up until the final round. And then immediately I won and I had to prepare another concert that was happening in 3 days.
Yeah.
And so I had to just keep working. And that was the one that was actually going to get the most coverage. And it happened that Jesus Lopez Cobos, who was the music director of the Cincinnati Symphony at the time, watched the concert and he liked it. And so he invited me to Cincinnati. And so my first, I mean, it was, you know, careers sometimes, you know, take a kind of slow burn trajectory. And and I was kind of thrown in the deep water right away with, you know, Cincinnati Symphony is one, you know, top orchestra. But I'll never forget the reason I told this story was that I went to the first rehearsal and the concertmaster was a good friend of mine that I went to school with.
Yeah.
And he asked me a question and he said, maestro? And it was dripping with irony. And it's like, come on, I know you. You're just Alan. But he called me maestro. Yeah. And the thing is that actually the word often has a kind of ironic undertone when people say, oh, maestro. And it used to mean, you know, master, or, you know, the boss, and it was simply that's what you call the maestro, and Toscanini was undoubtedly a maestro.
We have to talk about Toscanini, Alan.
We will. That's why I brought him up. There is one place though I have to say in Italy.
Yeah,
it's what they call the conductor, and it doesn't feel ironic. And actually, that's the place where it doesn't bother me that they. You know, I accept it because that's, you know, it comes with the job, but I don't demand that people call me maestro. I know that I have colleagues who expect to be called maestro, which to me feels unnecessary. Personally, I don't need it. And, I even would almost prefer not. But that's just the term, but there's the whole story and mythology. Yeah. I assume that's what you want to talk about.
I think we should start with Toscanini because
he's the quintessential maestro.
No question. Have this, you know, already my audio examples.
All this preparation you do, you know, I guess that's good. It's good to be prepared.
Yeah, sometimes it's prepared. And for you as a musician, you know what preparation means.
Actually, it's all about preparation. It's you have to be prepared, and that's, you know, we can talk about that also.
So, Toscanini, I have to play now this recording I found on the internet. It's a perfect example of what this maestro idea sounds like. Hang on.
No eyes, nothing at all.
Yeah, it's like a joke.
Yeah.
But it wasn't a joke because, I mean, he terrified people and that behavior was accepted. I mean, there's a lot of behavior that was accepted earlier that is not accepted today.
But he worked with fear. Somehow it seemed to be a concept which worked that time. Or
I wonder. Yeah. I guess. I mean, I guess that was the social structure and people say, oh, it worked then. But, you know, who's to say that it wouldn't have been better a different way?
But I know myself, these moments of fear at the Musikschule, the conductor of the Musikschule is shouting at the violins. And then I have to play by one has to play some bars.
I remember playing.
Do you know those moments?
Oh, yeah. I remember playing in pre-college orchestra where in order to strike fear into the players to make them practice. He said, okay, the conductor would say, okay, next rehearsal, if this passage doesn't sound good, each one plays it individually.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it made us practice. And yeah. And he did occasionally make us play it individually. I hated that. And I know how I felt being on that end. And yeah. That's actually something that I try to bring to what I do as a conductor is my actual experience of having played as a violinist in orchestras. Yeah. And, you know, it's not only psychological. If the conductor gives a gesture, how that makes me feel. And so that's an important aspect, I think, of who I am as a conductor is the experience that I've had playing in top orchestras. I played in Philadelphia Orchestra for 2 years, but also emotionally, psychologically, how it feels to be frightened and humiliated and shamed.
This concept of fear, I have to admit, sometimes it seems to be working. When I see this Chedi Bidaka recording of a rehearsal with the Berlin Philharmonics, and he screams at them to the groups of violins, and he's treating them like kids. Bruckner Symphony rehearsal. The result is astonishing.
Yeah.
Does the concept of fear work? What do you think sometimes?
I think as a motivating factor, fear is one of the techniques. And that's good, actually. I mean, we want to, you know, we're afraid that we're going to make a mistake or we're afraid that we're going to sound bad. And so there's this added pressure, but also can be debilitating. Mm-hmm. And so I would argue that, okay, in a sense, you can't argue with the result, but how do you know, call it scientifically, mm-hmm. that the fear was a necessary factor?
Yeah.
You know, it might have been done a different way. I don't know. Do you think that the players would not have produced as well or tried as hard if they weren't afraid and just felt supported and empowered? I don't know. I just have a lot of trouble with that concept because I don't think it was such a happy way to make music. And somehow the social structure made that allowed, just as it was allowed for the boss to you know, sexually abuse the secretary. Yeah. You know, that's like, well, the company did well. So, you know, it's like, how can you... I mean, that obviously doesn't hold water as an argument.
Yeah.
And we're learning. And so things are changing happily.
Master attitude, is it a matter of generations? Was it more common 20, 30 years ago?
Yeah, it's a very complicated subject. So it's interesting to talk about it. And in a sense, I should have answers because it's my life. It's what I do. It's my profession. But the balance between being collegial and democratic and friendly and encouraging and supportive.
As a person, you have a lot of power.
And as having a structure in an orchestra that is hierarchical.
Yeah, it is.
It is, and it should be. There are certain situations in which democracy and opening up every decision to general discussion is not only unwieldy, but clearly does not lead to the best result.
You have to,
as a conductor, find a way to have a natural authority and still be a nice person. An orchestra is one of the remaining sort of very clear examples of strict hierarchy that
and
I think you can
and
find.
It's anachronistic, I think, when you see the rest of the society and the
different
ways
the
society
different
works now. I just started reading No Rules Rules, a book about Netflix company by the CEO.
Okay.
And which is totally about the employees have so much freedom. Okay. About budget, when they want to go on vacation, everybody has to feel safe, and so on.
Yeah, it's something that I actually have thought about a lot, and I don't have any clear answers. Because what I describe when I am talking about the ideal chemistry between a conductor and an orchestra is a situation in which nobody feels that they're leading and nobody feels that they're following, including me. Mm-hmm. That there's a flow to the music that takes over. And the question is how to create that flow. Seiji Ozawa, who is one of my heroes and certainly one of the great conductors of the last century, Seiji said, the secret to conducting is to put the beats exactly when the orchestra expects to see the beats. Mm-hmm. And if you think about that, what does that mean? It means that the orchestra's playing, and if they're expecting a beat, if their music is flowing so that the next, that's where you should give the beat. On a surface level, that can seem kind of passive, as if you're just following or letting the orchestra determine the pace. But if you go deeper, it's actually meaning that there's a flow to the music that has been set up, actually, originally by the conductor, that the musicians can take and use naturally. And that if you put a beat that's not where they expect to see it, you're interrupting that natural flow.
Yeah.
And one of the students asked him, I said, yeah, but how do you change the tempo then? Ah, that's what the upbeat is for. So it kind of tells the whole story of conducting there, both empowering the musicians, guiding them, setting up a flow that you end up having to follow yourself.
Yeah, so you are both following a greater cause.
Exactly, yeah. And the music is more important than my personality or my feeling about the music or any musician's personality or feeling about the music. But that having been said, obviously, if you kind of make yourself faceless in front of the music and don't inject your personality,
what happens?
You're also not serving the music.
Okay.
If the music is unpredictable and capricious and wild, you also have to be that and show that and embody that. So it's not that you can just be passive, but it's about setting up an inevitability of the flow. And you talked about Celibidache and Toscanini. That was almost more than anything, I think, what characterized their performances is this sense that that's the only way the music could possibly go.
Yeah.
And Toscanini famously was so in control of his management of time that he could just sing the piece in his head, time it, and that's actually exactly how long the performance would take. He was that
precise,
but also just like committed to his vision of the piece. Yeah, so there was no other way it could go.
Did you ever get like screaming before an orchestra or lost your nerves or?
No, not so much. I mean, I've had some tense moments with orchestras. I don't think I've ever humiliated a musician. I don't feel like I want to because I, you know, I respect them and I think it's not nice to behave that way. I think that I've learned over the years to be patient. So they
when
know
you've
me
been younger, do you know those moments when you really want to, you think you lose?
There were times where I was more impatient and I felt like if things didn't go exactly the way that I imagined in my head, then I was somehow losing my authority or compromising. Yeah. And I think I've told this story before, but watching Yo-Yo Ma rehearse, he was playing, I think it was Schubert String Quintet with the Juilliard String Quartet, and it was an open rehearsal. And Yo-Yo Ma, who's obviously superstar musician, cellist, and really nice guy, was unfailingly agreeable and amenable to any idea that was presented to him. Could we go a little slower here? Oh yeah, sure. Could we take a little more time here? Sure, no problem. Could you play a little bit less? Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'd like to give two beats rather than, you know, whatever. Oh yeah, whatever you want. Fine. And he did it. And then in the concert, you had the impression that he was making all the choices and driving the whole thing. And he did all those things that they had rehearsed.
Yeah.
And it just made me realize that, you know, I was, you know, cocky kid, and I could do things. I played violin and I thought, okay, this is how it should go. And I was really picky about, okay, this much retard we have to do. No, that's too much. No. And like every little thing mattered so much to me. And that was kind of a light bulb moment for me. It's like, ah, it doesn't really matter if it's this much retard or that much retard. Yeah. You know, things can go this way or that way, and it doesn't mean that you're subverting your fundamental vision. It's a tricky subject, though, because I expect when I conduct orchestras to really be followed.
Yeah.
But I hope it's for the right reason. The reason I, like, and I tell this to the orchestra here, you know, when I'm picky, they think, well, so what if we do this much retard or that much retard? Yeah. I said, it's not that that much retard is bad. I need to set up a flow that the entire orchestra shares. And if you suddenly take it into your own hands and do more, noticeably more than what I'm showing, then you create a dilemma for the others. Mm-hmm. And they have to make a choice. Do we go with what we see or what we hear?
Yeah.
And that is a problem. And so it's not that I won't follow you if you want, but you can't suddenly break the flow and create your own flow.
What do you think about concerts like Orpheus Chamber Orchestra playing, okay, smaller orchestra without conductor, discussing everything?
They're wonderful. The rehearsal process is necessarily less efficient.
Yeah. Can you describe it maybe a bit? Because not everybody knows.
Orpheus is, you know, there are many such orchestras, but Orpheus is a well-known conductorless chamber orchestra based in New York City. And they famously discuss everything, and anyone is available to, you know, is allowed to say anything that they feel in the rehearsal. There is a kind of leader. I think the concertmaster is usually the one who kind of guides. So it's not exactly as democratic as they would like to say, because practically speaking, you have to have a kind of structure, I think.
Yeah. Final word.
I had this conversation with, this is a different subject, and I really have nothing bad to say about Orpheus, because they're wonderful players and they do great concerts. But a slightly different question, my very dear friend Enon Barnatan, the wonderful pianist with whom I've worked and collaborated on many, many projects, including a complete cycle of the Beethoven piano concertos that we recorded with the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields in London. And he was telling me years ago about his wish to do this project, and he was thinking, should he have a conductor? Should he do it non-conducting? Because these pieces are very often done without a conductor. And, you know, if I had any suggestions of who might be a conductor in that case, and I said, well, you know, I would love to do that if you would have me. And he said, really? But we were talking kind of philosophically even about whether there should be a conductor or not.
Yeah.
And I think it's very possible for a pianist to essentially be the conductor and do utterly satisfying performances. And I said, but in my experience, there's a different sense that can happen if the pianist is not responsible for the things that the conductor takes care of. So as long as the pianist and the conductor are seeing eye to eye musically, I said, I think that often the piano playing itself has more dimension when there's a conductor there.
So what, for example?
Well, just if you're having to think about like making sure that someone comes in, you can't devote as much of your bandwidth to the actual playing to playing freely and to doing something that is not as predictable or regular or metronomic. It's a generalization, but maybe you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Essentially, if you're not having to worry about the conducting function at all, you can devote more of your attention to imagination and pianistic questions. And I said, of course, that's based on the premise that you actually believe in the conductor and the conductor can support you in the way you want. And so bottom line is we ended up doing the recordings and I'm very happy with the way they turned out. And, you know, there are a lot of Beethoven cycles that are coming out now without conductors.
Yeah.
And they're fine. They're excellent. And I think ours is fine too. Just a different thing. But, you know, whether there's a conductor or not, it's actually hard to get everything to work
But you have to do these compromises again, the orchestra, conductor, and soloist. I remember, I think, was it Bernstein and Gould, which ended in a disaster?
Everything is a compromise. I mean, that's a famous story where they were so divergent on their views of the Brahms Piano Concerto that essentially Bernstein spoke to the audience and issued a disclaimer before the performance, which I think it was uncool. But you know, it's nice that we are able to talk about this and tell the story after all these years. But interestingly, if you hear that recording, it's not so strange at all. Actually, it's feels pretty, you know, not so extreme. But it's quite interesting, I think, the question of whether there should be a conductor or whether there shouldn't be a conductor. Because obviously, orchestras can play.
Is the result different? Yeah, totally different. Can you hear it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but it's like you can't compare something to nothing. Yeah. So if you go to a concert that has no conductor, it's like you can only in your head say, oh, well, if Carrion were conducting, it would sound better or it would sound different. That's a completely meaningless comparison.
Is it a different kind of playing? The players are engaged in a different way or?
Definitely engaged in a different way. And there can be a really great side to that because they have to take responsibility and they have to be aware. But I would argue that they should be aware in that way anyway, even if there's a conductor. Mm-hmm. So obviously some conductors make things worse. Some conductors make things better. Some orchestras can play well without a conductor. Some orchestras can't. It really depends on the actual individuals who are involved, finally.
Alan, how to become a superstar? Superstar, the best conductor in the world. What does it need? The recipe.
Does superstar mean the best conductor in the world?
I don't know.
I don't think we should assume that.
Okay, we agree on that. But yeah.
I'm not teaching now, although people do come to me for advice from time to time, but I used to be the professor of conducting at Juilliard. And my curriculum was very simple. There was a weekly lab orchestra, weekly seminars, and then there was a kind of free seminar that changed from week to week in which I tried to introduce as many areas as possible. So it could be Tai Chi, kind of body awareness. Mm-hmm. It could be speaking to a manager in the business. Mm-hmm. It could be meeting the librarian of the New York Philharmonic. Wow. It could be going to the driving range and hitting golf shots to do. I mean,
Do you
really,
do Tai Chi?
I did. I used to a little bit. I haven't practiced in a long time. Just as an example, though, it could be musical, too. It could be dealing with someone who's a specialist in Baroque performance practice or whatever. And I think that idea that being aware of as many areas as possible and having the richest background, essentially, is not just useful, essential to being a successful conductor. And what I miss more often than not when I see young conductors is call it a lack of background. Okay. Not having really experienced enough of orchestras or the music world or growing up within music or...
How did this happen? Familiarity did they concentrate
with, on a familiarity with
small track or?
Yeah, or they come to conducting just without actually having gotten to the point that they really should be thinking about conducting. Because in a way, conducting is easy. You can just stand in front of an orchestra. If you move your arms, they will play. You think you're actually doing something. Rudimentary level, it's easier to be a fraud as a conductor than it is for many others. I mean, you can't stand up on the violin and not really be able to play the notes. You actually have to be able to play the notes. You can move your hands like this and not have any idea what the orchestra is actually doing and kind of get away with it. And I think that the more background or sort of musical culture, however you want to call it, you have, the better chance you have of doing well. You can kind of feel it when someone stands in front of an orchestra and they don't really know what they're there for, what they're doing. Yeah.
What is your ideal conductor? What skills someone needs in the future to make? What do you tell your students in about 10 years? You were talking about those areas, but what kind of advice you would give young conductors for their career.
You know, we were talking in another conversation about cynicism and pessimism, and I am not a cynic when it comes to building a music career. I actually think it tends to work out, not always fairly, but you can see why people who are successful became successful. They have something that works and that makes it possible for them to exist in the public eye and carry up their end of the deal, hold their end of the deal up. It's not that every single successful person is the most musical person or has the best intonation or the clearest vision, but there's something that they bring to the equation that is compelling. I think it's important for me personally, and this is just about, you know, my own conscience and I think the attitude that I like to bring to what I do. I think it's important to do things for the right reasons. And if people are interested in being a conductor because they think it's a glamorous lifestyle and you travel and you stay in nice hotels, and that may or may not end up being true. It's not all that. You know, I can't complain. You know, I have a nice lifestyle. But if you do it for those reasons, I think there's a very high probability that maybe the results won't be as interesting as they really, really should be. It's a hard life. You have to work really hard. You have to constantly study. You always are being, in a way, judged, as is proper, I think, because you need
to. So you have to make sacrifices?
You have to make sacrifices all the time. I mean, I'm not with my family as much as I would like. Mm-hmm. I'm, you know, my oldest daughter just got her driver's license and she was excited. And I wish I could have been there to, you know, be with her when she, you know, drove me around. That would be fun. But, you know, that will have to wait. I think that it's important to really go deeply into the music. And it's hard to even know what that exactly means because it doesn't, and just because you spend 40 hours with a score doesn't mean you can necessarily learn it. But you do have to spend 40 hours to have a chance to really learn it. You know, some people are, I guess, cut out for it. Some people not as much. It's, you know, it's like with anything. It's what exactly are the ingredients that go into being a successful conductor? It's hard to pin down. But that having been said, a kind of natural authority, a comfort, and wanting to help people do their best and to give, and having the attitude that you want to sort of unleash the potential of the musicians around you, and then knowing well enough what they need in order to be able to do that. I mean, these are learnable skills to a degree, but then there's also this ineffable kind of charisma that I think is shared by all successful conductors. So, you know, how much of that is innate, how much of that is learned? It's a complex cocktail of qualities. But I will say that it's a wonderful profession, as hard as it is.
You would do it again.
I mean, because it calls on so many faculties. It's physical and it's emotional and it's spiritual and you get to deal with a lot of people and it's really about life and it's frankly never boring.
Without being a maestro. Thank you, Alan.
Well, we try our best, and I want to talk next time. We'll talk about your career, okay?
We will.
Deal. Thanks so much.
Thank you.